Coming up on Philosophy Talk, changing minds on climate change.
Is there anything left to say to someone who doesn't believe the climate is changing?
It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot.
Just the facts, ma'am.
When have facts ever changed anybody's mind?
Uh-oh. Now, what appears to be happening is that the water is rising. Why? One theory is, I don't know, I'm not a scientist.
The three stages of climate denial.
One, it's not happening.
Two, it's happening, but not here.
Three, it's happening, it's here, but it's not so bad.
Are climate deniers impervious to scientific evidence, or have they just not been exposed to the right kind of information?
Our guest is UC Berkeley psychologist Michael Ranney.
Changing minds on climate change.
Too darn hot.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Too darn
hot. Hey, philosopher, thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help now more than ever.
So here's what you do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
Can we ever change the minds of climate deniers?
Could the mere facts of global warming be enough to persuade them?
Or are some humans just too irrational to be convinced by evidence?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're thinking about changing minds on climate change.
You know, Josh, the ice caps are melting, forests are burning, temperatures are rising all around the globe. Something like 98% of all climate scientists agree. But surprisingly, there are still people, I mean, some of them with a lot of power who ought to know better, who deny climate change.
Yeah, tell me about it. It's infuriating. I mean, how are we going to avert a climate crisis if people are just too irrational to respond the way they should?
You know, I'm not sure it's all about irrationality. I mean, think of the fossil fuel industry and the politicians they've bought off. They spread what they've got to know is false information. Why? Well, so they can sow doubt, because they profit from the doubt. I mean, I'll grant you they might be among the lowest of the lows. I mean, maybe I can go a little lower than them. but yeah, I don't think I'd call them, like, irrational.
Well, what would you call them?
Well, I'd call them despicable. I'd call them immoral. I'd call them greedy, but not necessarily irrational.
Look, I'm prepared to accept that the fossil fuel industry is, you know, diabolically rational.
That's a good word for it.
But the people who listen to them, those folks, surely they are irrational. I mean, all the fossil fuel guys have is a handful of paid-off pseudoscientists. Why would anyone with half a brain choose to listen to them?
I don't know, Josh. I'm not even convinced that those people are being totally irrational. I mean, look, think about it. We've got the internet. We've got hundreds of TV channels. We've got social media all over the place. We're inundated with information, yeah, but also a lot of misinformation. And I think it could be really hard for an ordinary people to figure out what's true and what's false. And look, if add to boot that if your trusted news source is telling you that climate change is not real or that it's not caused by human activity, well, it's not, like, irrational to believe your trusted source.
Trusted news source, Ken. You're talking about what? Fox News? Breitbart? I mean, who on earth would trust sources like that?
Josh, come on. Where have you been? Millions of people? And you kind of seem to be implying, you know, they're all stupid and ignorant. That's hardly a way to change their minds, Josh.
Well, what do you suggest, Mr. Kill Them With Kindness?
I suggest you give them the facts. You give them scientific evidence. You trust them to be rational, and you don't treat them like, you know, idiots.
I love it that you're such a Pollyanna, Ken.
Girl.
I mean, you really think facts and evidence change people's minds?
Yeah, I do.
Well, if that's the case, how do you explain that in the 21st century, people are still taking up smoking?
Oh, come on, Josh. That's not fair. Smoking is different. Smoking is addictive. I mean, people often start smoking, you know, in their teens when their executive functions, you know, are a little questionable and not fully developed. You can't compare that with climate denial.
Actually, you know, I think we can. We're addicted to fossil fuels. You know, we need our big cars. We need our long-haul flights, our, you know, air con in the summer, our heat in the winter. We know full well there's an impending crisis, but guess what? We can't bring ourselves to give up a single one of our toys.
That's too pessimistic, because habits are changing slowly, but they're changing. I mean, people are buying solar panels, electric vehicles, reusable batteries. We're voting for laws that protect the environment. San Francisco, for example, just banned the sale of single-use plastic bottles.
Right, San Francisco.
You got something against San Francisco?
No, but you're talking about the true believers. You're talking about people who already accept the reality of climate change. What about the millions of folks who are still in denial?
Well, I think those people, they'll come around too. They'll come around eventually. You know, I think maybe you're the one who's in denial. You deny the possibility of hope.
Touche. Okay. Look, all I'm saying is San Francisco is not the world. And until we get money out of politics in this country, I just don't think we're going to get the wide-scale change we need.
Well, I'm going to completely agree with you. Totally. 100%. But, Josh, that does still leave the question, how to convince the skeptics to join the fight to save the planet?
Well, to help us think about that question, Ken, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to talk to some former skeptics who are doing just that. She files this report.
10 years ago, Richard A. Mueller was skeptical about climate change. Or, as he says, he was agnostic about the whole issue.
If you had asked me back then, what is your feeling about global warming, my answer would have been, well, I don't know.
Mueller is a retired UC Berkeley physics professor. He remembers having lunch with the department when a Nobel laureate walked in.
And as he walked in, he said, so, I've just been reading about global warming. Certainly everybody here believes in global warming, right? And everybody nodded their head except me, and I shook my head.
Mueller says he was suspicious the research at the time might be biased. So, at his daughter's suggestion, he put together a group of scientists to study the data. After intensive research, the team found the average temperature of the Earth had risen by 2.5 degrees over the past 250 years.
And our conclusion was global warming was real and it's caused by carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. That's a very strong, definite conclusion that I can defend in front of anybody, in front of any scientist, in front of the general public, because we did the work ourselves.
Now Mueller says he's in a unique position to convince others. He knows how to listen to skeptics and empathize. But not everyone can put together a team of researchers at an elite institution to address their own lingering doubts.
If you want to call me a denialist at the time, that was exactly it.
Reverend Richard Cizik, president of the New Evangelical Partnership for the Common Good, just needed to hear the science. He says back in 2002, he thought climate change was a myth.
I was a victim of what was the emissions of human greed, ignorance, and hatred. In other words, I would confess that even I had a degree of greed, a degree of ignorance, and yes, anger in part toward environmentalists and others who said my lifestyle was wrong.
Then Cizik says he experienced a conversion to science. A friend invited him to a climate conference. For 4 days, he learned about rising sea levels, deforestation, and pollution. Climate change was presented as a spiritual issue, and he felt a deep sense of repentance.
We don't have an option here. God says, I will destroy those who destroy the earth. And then the question is, who is that's doing this? And we have to say, all of us.
He says it really was that easy. After that, he changed his lifestyle and began educating other evangelicals about climate change. But he was ostracized and ultimately lost his job. It wasn't until 2015 that the National Association of Evangelicals adopted a statement that recognized climate change as a threat.
Those of us that are advocates for creation care, we see people changing their minds, especially among the younger evangelicals, the millennials. They know what's at stake. It's their future.
In fact, research shows that kids can be some of the most likely to convince skeptics. Daniel Lawson is a researcher at North Carolina State University. She recently tested this theory with a curriculum for middle school students. They were taught about the impact of climate change on animals. Lawson says these kids then inspire their parents to care more about the well-being of the planet.
There's a level of trust. If their child is talking to them about climate change, they may be less likely to see their child as an ideological threat.
She says concern about climate change jumped for conservative parents in particular, especially after their daughters talked to them about it.
Stop denying the earth is dying. Stop.
You say you love your children above all else, and yet you're stealing their future in front of their very eyes.
And Lawson says around the world, the young people leading climate strikes are keeping these conversations going.
They're not going to let us forget about it. It's having an impact in the sense that they're talking to politicians and to adults, but it's also influencing what's happening in a home.
So how do you convince a skeptic? Show them the facts. See if they're willing to talk to a reformed physicist or a converted evangelical, or see if a knowledgeable middle schooler is around to talk. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that uplifting look at this kind of depressing downer topic, Holly. That was awesome. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today we're thinking about changing minds on climate change.
We're joined now by Michael Ranney, cognitive psychologist at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Education and head of Berkeley's Reasoning Research Group. Michael, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
So, Michael, you're a psychologist, and you work on human reasoning. Lots of psychologists work on human reasoning. But I wonder, what got you interested and what keeps you interested in human reasoning about climate change in particular?
Well, I started off my publication career in a physics lab and worked on applied physics and material science. I did work interviewing physicists. And over time, I got more and more interested in physics education and cognition. And then there's a personal level as well where, you know, I had a child. I was worried about the future as the sort of roving reporter report came out. And part of me just doesn't want to, you know, be in a nursing home when I'm 115 and look in the eyes of younger people and say, you know, I could have done something, but, you know, TV was so good back then.
Yeah. Awesome.
So where do you stand on this question? You know, Ken and I were discussing a moment ago whether it's sufficient to give people the facts in order to persuade them that climate change is real. So what does your research tell us? Is it really possible to persuade people using evidence?
Yeah, I mean, facts rule, really. We have a website called howglobalwarmingworks.org, and there people can go to it and see the information that we provide in our experiments that we've empirically shown increases people's acceptance of global warming.
Wait a minute. You say facts rule. Mm-hmm. I mean, facts rule in the laboratory. Facts rule in the at least science classroom. Facts rule sometimes in philosophy classroom. But out there in the world, in the wild, I sure wish facts ruled, but it doesn't seem to me. I mean, if facts ruled, why is there so much climate change denial?
Well, facts definitely rule. In fact, we've run experiments where we give people a single statistic about immigration or abortion or something like that, and that changes people's minds in a heartbeat. Let's say that you were sure that your partner were fidelitous, but you came home and found that person, you know, in bed with a mail carrier. In a second, your empirical mind kicks in, and you change your mind about that.
Thanks for putting that thought in my head.
Do you ever see that movie, old Walter Matthau movie, How to Cheat on Your Wife?
Oh, no.
I'm sure I have.
It's a great comedy. And it's like, if you get caught in the bed with your lover, here's mm-hmm. how you get out of it.
That's right. We were trying to change a light bulb, and through a series of...
We both happened to fall...
Right, exactly.
So, yeah, but, I mean, so that's interesting, right? Because you've got scientific evidence. You've done the studies. You've shown there's a statistically significant correlation, right, that people's minds are actually changing because you're giving them facts, nothing else.
Right.
Just giving them
information.
Facts.
Mm-hmm.
So, Ken, why would you doubt this?
I don't doubt that in your laboratory facts rule. Mm-hmm. I don't doubt that at all. There's nobody on the other side saying, oh, don't believe that psychologist experimenter. Don't believe those are facts. But I'm talking about in the wild where people actually consume information and act on it. The claim that facts rule in the wild, as it were, where we all live, in our politics, on our television, in our... Why if facts rule, there wouldn't be all this climate denial.
Well, so instance, I live in the real world myself. I ride airplanes.
Yeah, I agree. So do I.
People look at the slides I'm working on a talk. One person thought that climate change was caused, or global warming was caused by volcanoes, and I had to help disconfirm that notion for him. And there are a lot of other instances in which a single statistic, you know, someone might think that methane has barely increased since the dawn of the industrial age, but in fact, it's almost tripled due to human causes.
We'll have to dig into this deeper because I'm not sure we're joining the issue in the way I want. But mm-hmm. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about changing minds on climate change with UC Berkeley psychologist Michael Ranney.
How easy is it to change people's minds using only facts and evidence? Can ideology-driven climate deniers ever be persuaded, or should we just give up trying?
Climate, evidence, and ideology. Plus, your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. Is waiting for the world to change its mind about climate change a hopeless cause? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy. Our guest is UC Berkeley psychologist Michael Ranney, and we're thinking about changing minds on climate change.
So again, Michael, I want to grant that if I get somebody in your lab and I give them the facts, pretty much they're going to go with the facts, especially if there's nobody lying in their ear, like Fox News or something. But I want to ask you a question. Some people just have this ideology that they have to give up, that is challenged by climate change. How do you get people like that to change their minds on climate change? You have to take a different... Is giving an ideologically rigid, closed-off mind the facts enough?
Well, often what I find is useful is I ask them why. So I'll ask them, well, okay, do you accept that Earth is heating up? If they don't, I'll say, well, what evidence would you need to know to see that? And then I provide them the evidence. If they say it is heating up, but it's not being caused by humans, I say, okay, what do you think that it's being caused by? And that's why I get in conversations about volcanoes and so forth. But often I can just ask them, okay, so like there are 150 glaciers in Glacier National Park in 1850. How many do you think there are now? And if they're really a denier, they might say, oh, I don't know, maybe 148. Maybe we lost a couple. Yeah. But if I say there are only 25 left, we only have 1/6 of the glaciers, those little facts begin to add up and eventually people tip over.
So again... That's uplifting to me. I don't know about to you, Josh. Josh was saying, people are irrational.
Right.
You're saying, no, people are rational. They respond to facts. But yeah. I still have this question for you. Why is there so much in the wild, as I call it, mm-hmm. in our actual discourse, our actual politics, and our actual media, why is there so much climate denial?
Well, obviously, some of it is due to desire to keep life as it is. That was sort of the intro piece, right? So there's going to be a balance between culture and information. There's not like a real dichotomy between the two in the same way that nature-nurture is not a real dichotomy in development. And so often you just have to listen to what people are saying and point out their error, but often they're just not getting the basic information. Like if people just learn the mechanism of global warming, something we have down to a haiku or 35 words, that changes people's minds.
You have a haiku for global warming?
Can I
do. You tell me your haiku for global warming.
Well, actually, it's better if I give you the 35 words.
Okay,
if you
okay. Fire away.
So it's Earth transforms sunlight's visible light energy into infrared light energy, which leaves Earth slowly because it's absorbed by greenhouse gases. When people produce greenhouse gases, energy leaves Earth even more slowly, raising Earth's atmosphere.
Now, Earth's temperature, right? I mean, that
Earth's
seems
temperature, yeah.
That seems totally reasonable to me. And you know, I was already convinced before, and I think if I hadn't been, you know, I'm a kind of person who likes to think I'm persuadable by evidence and fact. Mm-hmm. But you know, you're a psychologist. You must have read all the research about our various cognitive biases,
yeah,
right?
Confirmation bias, and on and on and on.
And the, mm-hmm. you know, the polarization effect, right? All these things. I mean, so you think if there's confirmation bias, then people are going to ward off all the kinds of information they don't like. And then there's the tribalism part. People feel it's part of their identity that we don't believe in climate change. And then you have this polarization effect where supposedly if you tell people facts that's designed to change their minds, that actually just makes them double down on their initial beliefs. So,
yeah, I think polarization is a weird situation because I think it's kind of an artifact of the laboratory situation, because often it's because psychologists using deceit and vignettes that are counterbalanced are used in a way that often the participants know that they're being gamed somehow.
I see.
So one of the things we do is we tell people, look, this is real information. You can share this with your family tonight. You can Google it, you know, when you're done to make sure we're telling you the truth. And so we find that even conservatives, the most conservative people we have, increase their acceptance of global warming. That is, our information rises all boats. It doesn't polarize. But you're right, if people get a sense like, oh, I might be propagandized, yeah, then they're going to potentially even double down. And early indications on, you know, capital punishment suggested that when people have that, they can even become more firm in their position.
Look, we've got a bunch of callers on the line. And Susan in San Francisco is our first caller. What's your comment or question, Susan?
Hi. I was just going to say that I think when talking about global warming, if people say there's an average rise of 2.5 degrees, that is not helpful in persuading people that it's a serious problem. Because people think 2.5 degrees, big deal. You know, I live in a range that goes from, you know, 28 degrees in the winter to 90 degrees in the summer. So 2.5 degrees, so what?
Yeah.
I think it's much better to talk about things like sea level rise and extreme weather events and things that are actually having a visible impact rather than this 2.5 degrees. I mean, I know from doing open water swimming that, you know, 3 degrees difference can be huge, but most people don't know that.
Thanks for that call, Susan. That's a great call. It raises a larger effect that I want to question, and it connects up to something Josh says. It turns out human beings are suckers for framing effects, right? If you frame a question in one way,
right,
you get one answer. You frame that same question in a different way that's asking about the same thing, but you frame it in terms of losses instead of gains or something, people give you a completely different answer. Kahneman and Tversky argued that's a form of irrationality. I wonder, do you find that in trying to persuade people about climate change, that framing effects creep in and it matters how you frame it to them? Or is it just give them the facts and don't worry about the framing?
So the framing does matter, but what we try to do is we try to give people information that they would want to know, free of sort of like some obvious frame. So we'd say, well, what would you really want to know if you were going to assess whether global warming is happening? But I think the caller is quite spot on. Unless you provide an accurate context for 2.5 degrees, I mean, if your temperature went up 2.5 degrees, you would be worried about yourself, right? If you increase the temperatures in the Great Barrier Reef by 2.5 degrees, you no longer have one gender of turtles. They're all the same gender. And that's really bad for turtles, right? So if you think about it in those terms, but what we do is like we have graphs that show temperature over time from 1880 to today. And if you average it enough, if you take out those variations that people confuse, the way that people confuse weather with climate, but if you take out those variations, it's going up like a jet. It's virtually monotonic in its increase.
So yeah, but again, I feel like, you know, Susan's still got a point. So if you give people that information, that's sort of dry, abstract, factual information that mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily feel like it connects with people's lives. And I always think about the ancient rhetoricians talking about, you know, ethos, logos, and pathos. Mm-hmm. You know, you can use logos, you can use reason, you can use facts and evidence, but that's not enough.
Yeah.
But literally, think about if your temperature, your body temperature, actually increased 2.5 degrees throughout the entire life. Now, it might be higher or lower. Well,
so, that's starting to be a good argument, but I think about things like telling people, hey, you like hunting? Soon the fish, there's not going to be no fish for you to fish. Soon there's going to be no animals for you to hunt. You want to live in your house by the ocean, mm-hmm. you're not going to be able to live there.
So we have a colleague at Stanford, Jeremy Bailenson, who's in communications, although mm-hmm. he's trained as a cognitive psychologist, and he works on virtual reality. He mm-hmm. started working in virtual reality before cognitive scientists started thinking a lot about this. He's mm-hmm. one of the pioneers, and he has an experiment, a series of experiments, to increase what he calls environmental empathy, and it immerses people in the facts about climate change. It doesn't just tell them. It gives them an upfront.
This is a virtual reality.
Yeah, this is a virtual reality. You can walk around walk around the melting ice caps and stuff, and mm-hmm. it's apparently extraordinarily effective. And that goes back to Susan's point. I mean, do you have to make it? I mean, people. You know, people are pretty good statistical reasoners, but only pretty good. A lot of work has shown that.
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind is that people are quite different, right? So the way I liken an individual who denies global warming is that they're sort of a table being propped up by a few shaky legs. Now, person A may have 3 legs. Person B may have 4 legs. They may have completely different sets of legs. But if you actually address what those legs are, like one person might not know the mechanism, one might not know the effects, one might not know the sea level rise. Like one of the things that's sort of shocking to people that if all the ice on the planet melts, our sea levels will rise over 200 feet. Now, that's not going to happen in the next few years or anything, right? But if you think about the amount that sea level could rise, you realize what sort of dangers are out there.
Right. We've got more callers on the line. Stephen in San Francisco, what's your comment or question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to point out that the term climate change was coined about 20 years ago by Fred Luntz, specifically to disarm urgency about global warming. It's less scary than global warming. And in spite of this, it's sort of the, you know, the coin of the realm. Everyone calls it climate change. And, you know, in some way, I think it contributes to inaction or stasis on doing something about it.
That's really interesting.
Let me add that Luntz has since disavowed climate denial and is, you know, calling for people to do something about it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, he was one of the people who was driving the push to discredit science by emphasizing that it was a controversy.
But that's one of, back to those framing effects.
Totally.
If you frame it the right way, right, you can sell it the way you want. If you frame it the wrong way, you can't sell it the way you want.
I've heard the opposite claim that global warming is not the best term, because then politicians cynically can say, well, we had a cold winter, so I guess global warming isn't happening.
Well, we actually have empirical evidence on this, that when you ask people about climate change, they confuse it with weather, whereas global warming is more clear that it's talking about the heating up of the planet. And in fact, I make a distinction, so I think we can take back climate change in spite of its origins, that global warming is really the fundamental phenomenon. That is, that on average, the planet is increasing its temperature. Climate change is an entire set of effects based upon that, that includes the melting of ice caps, the desertification of landscapes, acidification. So climate change is what happens due to global warming.
I get all that. What I'm wondering about, Luntz is a marketing type guru who helped advise Republicans on how to frame issues.
Right. Merchants of doubt, yeah, that you have on your website. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And but so I you know, some people say progressives, I don't want to identify myself as anything here. Progressives are just bad at these framing things. I mean, do you think that's true or not? Do you think?
Well, I think that progressives have a way to go. I'd have to run a study to see if they're really different. But one of the things that I do to help disarm people who deny global warming, and I give talks in red states, I love doing this, in Kansas, Missouri, Indiana. What I'll do is I'll start off by explaining the motivations of scientists. And I don't think this is clear to many people, but scientists aren't rewarded by just going along with other people.
Yeah.
We're rewarded by really transforming paradigms. And so I point out that virtually all climate scientists wish the global warming were not true. So the fact that they accept it is really sort of stunning. And in fact, I even make this pledge. I say that if someone could please convince me that global warming were not true, which I would love to be the case, I would rent the biggest SUV I could find, drive to wherever that person is, shake their hand, stop doing work on this entirely, give back any money I ever got related to this, and I would even probably win the Nobel Prize, because I would publish this. And can you imagine if you could actually disconfirm global warming, how famous you'd be?
I know.
Let alone,
I know.
You'd get a beer in any bar you'd go into. Right?
That's a nice point. I think most people, that's a really nice point.
So the motivation that somehow we're just involved in this weird, elaborate hoax is just insane.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
not how science works.
No, not at all. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about changing minds on climate change. We'd love to have your comment or question. And Dan in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dan. What's your comment or question?
My point for me is I have a number of friends who don't agree with global climate change correlated with carbon dioxide levels, and that really has to do more with the fact that they believe that the scientific enterprise, of which I am part, is hopelessly corrupted by funding and that scientists are elitists. And what it really comes down to, unfortunately, is not the information that they receive, but who they receive the information from and who they trust. And I guess my question maybe is, how do we build trust in single source of information? That, because really the media gets caught up in overinterpreting the data too, and, you know, attributing everything to global warming these days. So
thanks for the question, Dan. I think actually you're raising a really profound question. I think, Michael, I agree with you about the nature of science and all that, but I don't believe that that fact has widely penetrated the consciousness of Americans, because we are such a polarized, politicized. I mean, you know what just happened. I mean, I don't want to date this call, but there was the hurricane. Trump said it's going to
Alabama,
and it turns out in the news this morning, the head of the weather service or something sent around a letter saying don't contradict Trump, right? And all the scientists were upset and are in arms and are blowing the whistle. But that's what our politics has become.
I mean, it would have hit Montana too, but just as a very gentle breeze.
But that's what our politics has become, right? People are so distrustful of anything that goes against their belief. How do we break through that?
Well, I think it's also helpful to understand the motivations of people, because, you know, if you're running a shrimp shack on the banks of the Gulf, even though you're not being paid by the fossil fuel industry, if you're selling your shrimp sandwiches to people off the oil rigs, you're related to it. And so I think there's that. There's also a fear. And one of the things that I try to point out is that we can actually fix global warming relatively quickly and easily and inexpensively if we act. And the sooner we act, the better it'll be. But people often hear this doom and gloom. And studies have shown if you don't talk about how we can fix it, how it's readily changeable, how cheap sustainable fuels are, then people turn off because, you know, you're frightened, right? If you have this sort of learned helplessness response otherwise.
So it sounds like it's a combination of things. Let's get back to ethos, logos, and pathos, right? You've got the logos, you've got the evidence and the facts. Mm-hmm. But you've also got emotion. You've got the fear combined with the hope. It's going to be a problem for your shrimp, but there is, hope is on the way if we take action.
Right.
And then you've also got the ethos. You've got trust. You know, I'm someone you can trust.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not your enemy. You know, we're on the same side. So it seems like maybe the ideal strategy is a combination.
Yeah, and I think trust is really important, and we're doing some empirical work on this. It turns out that really the general public does trust scientists a fair amount. I mean, if they're going to predict that there's an eclipse tomorrow, you know, even people who might think the Earth is flat, although there are very few of those people, you know, will begin to think, maybe there will be an eclipse, right? And so, in it also, I can point out that scientists have really very good employment. I mean, the unemployment rate for people with PhDs is like 0.75%.
In the sciences, not in the humanities.
Well, even overall, I teach a class on how to get a job after your PhD. So this is more than a passing interest. And so it's not like these people couldn't do things outside of climate. I certainly was not interested in climate change as an issue or a scientific topic. I'm interested because it's important.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about changing minds on climate change with Michael Ranney from the UC Berkeley Psychology Department.
Are people fundamentally rational or irrational? Do we form our beliefs based on evidence or something else?
Humans, the rational or the irrational animal? When Philosophy Talk continues. Can we get more people to take a chance on the evidence and change their minds on climate change? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and our guest is Michael Ranney from the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Education.
And we've got a caller on the line, John in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John. What's your comment or question?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Maybe I came in late, but I'm having a bit of a problem understanding the gist of your guest's position. Is it that certain means of persuasion are found to be more valid and reliable in predicting an outcome than others? And if that is true, has your guest also attempted to use the same means of persuasion to take a random group of people and move them against the climate change thesis?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, but we did publish a study that way. Yes, you can, in fact, frame information in such a way that it increases the doubt about global warming. I mean, you have to cherry pick it, and it's terribly misleading. But I think the reason that you know it's misleading is that if you ask people, well, what would it take you to convince you that your position is wrong, and then let's look at those data, that's when people are probably are best compelled. And in fact, when you marble together These sort of more representative statistics that we have with these misleading or cherry-picked statistics, people can tell the difference. So if I give you the choice between two graphs, one that shows the temperature change in Peoria, Illinois in 1991, or one about the entire planet from 1880 to today, which of those two graphs do you want? Well, of course, given the contrast, you're going to want the one that has the most 4D extent, the largest extent over time and space, right? Not Peoria in 1991, right? But if you're just given Peoria in 1991 and it's purported that this is representative of what our climate is doing, then yeah, you might be misled by that.
So I got to tell you, you sound like an optimist to me, especially for a psychologist. Because I got to tell you, psychology, social psychology, and all the experiments by people like Kahneman and Tversky and loads of students who followed in their wake, part of what helped convince me, not the only thing, but part of what helped convince me that human rationality is way oversold. The rationality of everyday human cognition. I don't mean science, right? Because that's a big, complicated cultural achievement. But the individual mind doing its everyday reasoning, its rationality is way oversold. But you make the individual cognizer sound a lot more rational in not just what it concludes from the evidence, but in its evidence-seeking behavior, right? Confirmation bias says, oh, I'm going to seek out the information that confirms me, and I'm going to discount any information that's offered. I'm certainly not going to seek out disconfirming evidence. And somebody offers it to me, I'm going to discount the evidence, and I'm going to discount them for pushing it in my face. But you make it sound like people are actually hungry for good evidence.
I think that's the case. And getting back to the first part of your point, I am optimistic. And as people see that the solution to global warming and climate change are in our mental horizon and in our pathway, they will feel that too. In fact, we have fun in my research group because there are elements that can give you pleasure when you see that the solution is in with your grasp. In terms of rationality, I've actually written a paper relating to that. And I think part of the difficulty is when people are banding about whether people are rational or not, is that we're a mixture of both, right? And some of this relates to our goals. So for any given moment, I might have 100 to 200 goals. I mean, pretty soon I'm going to want to eat, but I also want to stop climate change. You know, I'd like, you know, my finances to be a little bit better than they are. They're all these, and they're also modulating in terms of their importance. And so what people are trying to do is to try to be fidelitous to their goals. You're trying to satisfy all these goals at once under changing conditions. And it might seem like people are irrational, and perhaps people are, but unless you know that person from the inside out, it's very hard to say if they are.
That suggests that to the extent that there is irrationality and massive widespread irrationality, it might show up not in adjusting an means to an end, not in the pursuit of a goal, but in balancing the kind of competing goals. I mean, balancing the kind of competing goals is really hard. And I actually don't know that the theory of rational choice or any of that stuff has told us this is how you do it.
Right. And it varies so much in the circumstances. So if you're living hand to mouth and your income is indeed related to the fossil fuel industry and your children are in danger of losing their home or not being fed enough, then climate change is not the top of your list, and you may not act that way. And that's one of the reasons why those nations that have the best resources should be tithing their part, sending money to help the Amazon and so forth.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Always want more comments and questions, and we got Rosa in Oakland on the line. What's your comment or question, Rosa?
Okay, I feel that to help people understand this better, that maybe the title of, this crisis should be called Global Warming Acceleration Crisis.
Mm-hmm. That's very modern in Silicon Valley.
Sometimes people call it global heating, just to make it clear that way. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But that would acronym nicely to GWAC.
And I just want to say that, to tell people, that yes, climate has changed over the ages, but it happens slower, when it's natural, and giving things time to adapt and evolve. But now that we're doing things that are accelerating the change, that's the reason why we need to do something, because we're just making it faster.
Right.
Yeah, and if people could think of their body like the earth, and what we do, people are so into healthy things, what we do to our body could accelerate our death or help us to live longer, depending on what choices we make.
Well, that's a little tricky, because the accelerator, people like to use accelerator as a good word these days, like a technology accelerator, right? An ideal accelerator.
Well, one way to think about it is in terms of the pace of change. So, for instance, you know, our planet has survived to some degree or another with climate changes in the past, but they've been more slow. So, for instance, I've seen one analysis that suggests that organisms are going to need to migrate about a yard a year in order to survive. Well, that's not too bad if you're a squirrel, but if you're a redwood, moving a yard a year is difficult, let alone, you know.
You're kind of rooted. Yeah,
right? How are you going to move over like the Sierras and come down into Nevada? That's
right.
Just not. Yeah. So it's really the pace of change, and that's why we're having the number of species
organisms,
problems as they are.
Organisms are going to have to move a yard a year, and as those organisms move a yard a year, this is something that I tell people. Oh, you're upset about immigration and migration now? Mm-hmm. You haven't seen anything yet. Unless we deal with this global warming crisis where so many places on the earth will not be fit for human habitation, it'd be a massive movement of people.
Indeed, a lot of social scientists have shown that we're already seeing the effects of climate change and migrations, that the Syrian exodus is not just about ethnic cleansing or ethnic conflict. It's also about
exactly.
The land turning to desert. There not being food. Bangladesh is having their delta inundated by salt water.
So I go back to this goals thing. And because I hear you, and I want to believe, I want to be an optimist. I really want to be an optimist. But I look at the thickness of the prevalence of denial. Even though there are lots of people like you, lots of really smart people out there ringing the alarm, mm-hmm. right? You don't have the bully pulpit of some of the deniers. You don't have, and the bully pulpit isn't just an informational bullpit. It's a kind of self-interest thing. Back to this, the
well,
economies,
the thing,
all
right.
This sort of stuff. I mean, how do you?
And it's self-interest on the part of the fossil fuel industry, you know, the politicians.
But empirically, but also, you can see how quickly people do change their minds. Like, look how quickly the mean of the population changed toward thinking that gay marriage was all right. And even more poignantly, more recently, there was this flip-flop about Russia. So before Trump was elected, the conservatives and Republicans were way more concerned about Russia than were the liberals.
Okay,
that flipped within about 6 months.
I agree that minds can be changed quickly, but I don't think that necessarily the change is always in the direction of the true and the good. I think the human mind walks around. Now, science mostly marches in the direction of the more likely to be true, but social life is not science. Social life is a mess.
And in addition, I mean, I want to press mm-hmm. you a little bit on changing attitudes to gay marriage,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of that, it seems to me, was driven by the coming out movement. And so here, what you really had was a kind of appeal to basic human goodness. It was ultimately an emotion appeal. Look, you know someone. You might have been living under a rock, but now you know that some of your best friends and your closest family members are gay. Don't you care about them? Don't you want them to be happy?
If your name is Dick Cheney, you don't.
Well, okay, but right. But I think the success of extraordinary and wonderful success of that movement had to do with ethos. It had to do with, you know, and pathos, an appeal to emotion, an appeal to who the person is and what their relationship is to you. So that seems like a very different kind of
every
case.
Movement has a momentum and so forth. But there are inflection points. And I think that when Joe Biden, for all of his warts and so forth, when he thought, when he came out saying that was fine, that changed a lot of minds. And I think it was a tipping point. And I think we're moving to the tipping point in climate change as well. In fact, if you look at surveys, the number of people who are most alarmed about climate change has doubled. Doubled from December of 2013 in 5 years to December 2018. December 2013 was right when our website, How Global Warming Works, came out.
That was the tipping point.
Correlation is causation.
In this case, I'm willing to entertain the hypothesis. Anyway.
So the kids are going to save us. Maybe Greta Thunberg, people like that.
And the numbers of deniers are dwindling. Yep. There are only 16% who are now in the two most denialish camp, whereas 60% are in the most accepting
camps. I'm going to ask you.
We've already flipped.
I'm going to ask you. I know you're a psychologist, not a social prognosticator, but how long can the deniers, who are a diminishing minority, how long can they hold out? When will denying climate change be like denying the Earth is around? Or
well, when I first started giving talks about this, like around 2013 or so, I said that in 20 years everyone will accept global warming, and I think I could still hold to that, and I think the data are showing that momentum. there certainly is a political asymmetry, but even that's shifting. If you look at the people who used to deny that global warming was even happening, that is, that we were heating up, now they're saying it is heating up, and maybe humans are causing it, but it's not that much, or it's too expensive. So on this continuum of flat-out denial of the phenomenon to the extreme being, we got to work on this right now, the entire population is moving.
Okay, on that note of optimism, I'm going to thank you, Michael. It's been great to talk with an upbeat psychologist for once.
Thanks.
Our guest has been Michael Rainey. He's a cognitive psychologist at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Education. He's head of Berkeley's reasoning research group. So, Josh, you got a brief bit of reasoning for me now?
Yeah, look, I like the idea that sort of all of the above, you know, that maybe facts and evidence can work. Well, that's a fantastic, discovery that our guest, Michael Rainey, you know, came up with. That's wonderful. But, you know, let's not discount other things. Here's what I think we should do when somebody says that global warming is a hoax. Turn it around and then say no. The claim that it's a hoax, that's a hoax.
Yeah.
They want you to believe it's a hoax so they can steal Greenland for their globalist plot.
There's one thing that we didn't talk about, though, enough, is that the role of politics in distorting human decision-making, and especially a political system like ours, in which money controls things, in which the rural minority has a disproportionate share of political power and getting decisions, and China wants to dominate the world, and so they have a certain interest. So it's a really complicated thing. If it were just believe the true and the good will follow, I would be a lot. But you know what? This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blago. I think, this is with apologies to Descartes, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed on today's show, or if you're bedeviled by a conundrum in your own life and could use some philosophical insight, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at conundrums@philosophytalk.org.
Now, here's a guy who changed his mind using speed alone. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I came over for lunch one day in junior high and told my mother that Mr. Johnson, the health teacher, had informed us that the governor of California was a communist. No, my mother told me he's a Democrat. My mother then informed me that people believe all sorts of crazy things, a lesson I've taken to heart over the years. Mr. Johnson also said the world's going to run out of oil by 1970. Why he was selling this to a bunch of 12-year-olds, I do not know. Maybe he wanted us to head for the bunkers while we were still unable to drive, thus adding a few years of oil use before the crisis. Well, here we are in 2019, and we still have oil, although we might be hitting bottom, like using the spatula to scrape out the last of the peanut butter. It's hard to build consensus around a crisis, unless you can literally see the floodwaters roaring at us. Just go buy more peanut butter. No, it's all gone. Well, then we won't eat peanut butter anymore. What's the big deal? The trouble with climate change is that words are our enemy. It used to be called global warming, and any fool could see winter was still cold. What are you even talking about? Before that, of course, it was the Cold War, and it was communists that threatened capitalism, not these damn tree huggers. So the language changed. But is climate change really a crisis? Is it really man-made? People have a hard time accepting that. I don't know why. You'd think bringing a planet to its knees would be something to brag about. It proves our dominion. Also, come on, it'll bounce back. It always does. Not so reassuring when you see half the state of California on fire and you're wearing gas masks to the Safeway. But come on, Safeway's still open. Out of peanut butter, but open. Just a phase, nothing new, same old, same old. Whiny libtards can't take the heat and they won't trust the wisdom of the marketplace, which is smarter than a junkyard dog. Conservatives also think they're taking the blame for a crisis that doesn't exist, which means if it does exist, they can't escape blame. Which may help explain the weird behavior from the president of Brazil, who tweeted that he would not accept French help to plant new trees and fight the huge Amazon rainforest fire, unless the president of France apologizes for insulting him. Also, in throwback to Cold War lingo, the Brazilian president claimed that the French president disguises his intentions to save the Amazon as if it were a colony. Well, plundering of the Amazon has been going on for years. Illegal poaching of lumber, burning a forest to create farmland, clearing it to make room for the upwardly mobile to build their cute little houses free of snakes, toxic frogs, and hostile natives with poison darts. Climate change will end all that. See, that's the dark secret here. There are many who can't wait for it to catch fire and burn. The poor will die, the losers will die, the whiners will die, leaving more than enough oil for the rich survivors to snowmobile in their new styrofoam winter getaways. Why do you think we made that half-hearted offer to get Greenland? That'll be shorefront property when the icebergs melt, baby. Drink your juleps from your bungalow and watch the tankers pass by laden with oil and ambergris and blubber and polar bear rugs for you to dry your feet before you come back into the house. I sometimes think this is what climate change deniers not only secretly believe will happen. They hope and work for it. Of course, there would still be dangers. Sea serpents, the Kraken, awakened from their ancient slumber, may prove easily adaptable to our new Florida clime, a depleted world chock full of tasty, overweight billionaires. And there could also be mutated survivors with lungs like leathery wings flapping in their hollow chests. They have fangs, talons, grievances. They are easily triggered. Identity politics is their jam. They say they are vegan. They say they're here for the recycling. Just outside the door, lightly tapping. You can let them in? I would not. If I were you, I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2019.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I'm not qualified to debate the science over climate change.
I'm not a scientist.
What I have said repeatedly is I'm not a scientist.
Yes, everyone who denies man-made climate change has the same stirring message. We don't know what the f*** we're talking about.